This is Radio MD COVID-19 Daily, your source for COVID-19 news from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Caitlin White. Welcome back to another week. It's Monday, April 6th. I hope you found some moments of calm during your weekend. We'll hear some interviews after this update on pregnancy, deliveries, and COVID-19, and also how loneliness was an epidemic even before we were all in social distance mode. COVID-19 could become a seasonal illness. That's coming from National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director Anthony Fauci. The doctor was on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday morning and said, unless we get this globally under control, there is a very good chance that it will assume a seasonal nature. He went on to say we need to be prepared that since it will be unlikely to be completely eradicated from the planet, that as we get into the next season, we may see the beginning of a resurgence. Fauci also said it would be a false statement to say the U.S. government has the coronavirus pandemic under control. While so much of our focus has been, of course, on how COVID-19 is affecting humans, what do we know about the virus in animals? Radio MD's Bill Klaproth has this roundup on studies and cases of COVID-19 in our furry friends.
A tiger at the Bronx Zoo has tested positive for the new coronavirus in what is believed to be the first known infection in an animal in the U.S., federal officials in the zoo said Sunday. The 4-year-old tiger and 6 other tigers and lions that have also fallen ill are believed to have been infected by a zoo employee who was asymptomatic, the zoo said. The employee and the animals are all doing well and are expected to recover. Researchers around the world are studying the possibility of COVID-19 infection in domestic animals such as dogs and cats. However, the World Small Animal Veterinary Association says, to date, we confirm that there is still no information proving that a COVID-19 infection in a dog or cat can be passed on to other animals or to humans. For Radio MD News, I'm Bill Klaproth.
One of the best-known symptoms of coronavirus is a fever. But when we're talking about a fever, what exactly does that mean? Radio MD's Scott Webb has more.
We've all heard that a fever may possibly be a sign that you have COVID-19. Of course, fever and a high temperature could just be an indication that your body is fighting a more common infection. Though a temperature of 98.6 Fahrenheit is widely considered to be the optimal body temperature, normal body temps can actually range from 97 to 99 degrees Fahrenheit. Our body temperatures tend to be higher in the morning and then go down during the day, so when should you be concerned about your temperature? If you have a fever and your temperature is 100.4 or greater, doctors agree that your body is fighting off an illness. As it relates to COVID-19, if you have a fever that is accompanied by a dry cough and shortness of breath, you should contact your doctor immediately. Reporting for Radio MD News, I'm Scott Webb.
Pregnancy is supposed to be a time of joy and excitement. Buying little baby clothes, getting a room set up, creating a birth plan with your doctor. But as we hear daily updates on COVID-19 and constant reminders to wash our hands, being pregnant during this time could feel overwhelming. What are some extra precautions that pregnant people and their partners can take to stay safe and healthy during this pandemic? I spoke to Avery Fisher, a certified nurse midwife with AFA, OBGYN, and Emerson Hospital, about some of these concerns.
So back in the hospital, how is labor and delivery screening patients for COVID-19?
So at this point, every patient and their partner on arrival is being asked about symptoms of COVID-19. Those symptoms right now include cough, fever, body aches, sore throat, shortness of breath or difficulty breathing, or any known direct contact with anyone who has COVID-19. So all patients and their support person on arrival are being asked these questions. Any patient who's identified to be at risk will be appropriately isolated and cared for in a safe way to make sure everyone else stays safe. And if the patient's support person does answer yes to any of those symptoms, then they would not be allowed into the hospital. So we are screening everyone in that way on the way in the door.
And how are the labor and delivery and postpartum departments protecting patients and babies during this outbreak?
That's a great question. So we do have a designated negative pressure room on our postpartum unit, and just yesterday transitioned one of our labor and delivery rooms to a negative pressure room as well. Negative pressure is a type of isolation technique used in hospitals to decrease cross-contamination from room to room. So these rooms will be used for any patients with either suspected or known COVID-19. All of our staff, including doctors, midwives, nurses, techs, labor and delivery, postpartum, everyone is trained in the appropriate use of precautions for caring for patients with known COVID-19, suspected COVID-19, or any other respiratory illness. So the appropriate use of gowns, masks, gloves when caring for any patient with a suspected infection. While there has been a lot in the media recently about hospitals running out of basic protective equipment like gloves and masks, Emerson has an appropriate supply right now to cope with any known COVID-19 patients. So we are not at the point at Emerson Hospital's labor and delivery right now where we are running out of supplies.
Will the COVID-19 pandemic change options for pain management during labor?
So a lot of our patients do ask a lot of questions about pain management generally. The hospital does have in-room showers, use of injectable medications like morphine, and of course, epidurals.
That kind of leads me into my next question. Again, a patient possibly having COVID-19, would they be able to stay in their room with their baby postpartum?
So at this time, we are not separating moms and babies on postpartum after delivery. Of course, any baby of a healthy mom is encouraged to room in, and we're actually not allowing babies to go to the nursery. So some patients do sometimes use the nursery for a bit of respite care, a couple hours of sleep here and there throughout their stay because they're learning to take care of a newborn. They've just had a baby. They're really tired. And this is a service we usually offer. And for healthy moms and babies, we are not offering this option right now. So all babies will be rooming in and not allowed to go out to the nursery unless a procedure needs to be done or additional monitoring for the baby needs to be undertaken. For patients with known COVID-19 or suspected COVID-19, babies will be able to room in with moms, must stay in the room with moms, and breastfeeding will continue. So we are encouraging a breastfeeding and/or pumping relationship for patients who want that with appropriate precautions taken. So there is not a plan at this time to separate moms and babies.
You can hear a longer version of that interview and many more with the doctors of Emerson on their podcast, Health Works Here. That's on all podcast platforms and at emersonhospital.org. As social distancing guidelines keep getting set out farther into the spring and even summer in some places, the side effects of being alone inside are getting to some people. But one doctor says loneliness was a problem even before COVID-19. I called up Dr. Roger McIntyre, the professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at the University of Toronto, to chat about just this. Here is part one of that interview.
You say that there are two current epidemics, the viral pandemic itself and a stress pandemic propagated by social media. Tell us a bit more about that.
We are all clearly aware of the pandemic that is occurring and that has its immediate medical hazard that we're all aware of. Mm-hmm. In addition to this event, which is not only a medical event, this is an economic, this is an employment event. And we are about to witness, and we're already seeing it actually, some of the most dramatic and abrupt changes in macroeconomic indicators that we've seen in a lifetime with respect to the abrupt change in unemployment, the abrupt change in employment security, and the abrupt change in financial security. Each of these factors alone, and certainly together, are highly associated with not just stress, but are associated with mental illness like depression and alcohol-related problems. What's especially concerning, and this is not some type of theoretical notion, this is a notion that was observed during the financial crisis, is the increase in suicide. Mm. And this is something that is obviously extremely concerning. The part about this stress pandemic or that we're seeing here, which is different than the financial crisis, is that when the financial crisis took place, first, not all countries were affected. This coronavirus is a global phenomenon. But second, and more germane to my sort of thesis here, is that in contradistinction, in other words, unlike the financial crisis, we are all being told to stay in our homes, and we're being told to socially isolate, to socially distance. And in some places, as you know, certain states and regions, this is legally mandated. This is something you're being forced to do. It'd be illegal to breach these orders. And that was not the case with respect to the financial crisis. So we as a species, human beings, when under stress, we are able to buffer that stress, go with the punches, so to speak, by relying on meaningful quality-related social supports, friends, good friends, family, loved ones. This is how we buffer stress. And that opportunity still presents itself in this current situation of social isolation via various technology platforms. But therein is also a problem, because we also know, based on research that we've just completed in China in the wake of this COVID-19 crisis, is that, like us, they are also experiencing, and we've been able to measure this, a significant increase in anxiety and depression and stress. But interestingly, the more time people spent on social media, the more people reported being stressed and depressed and anxious. And this is part of a, I think, an observation which has been made before. And that is that social media engagement does not equate with quality interpersonal supports. And the more time people spend on social media, the more likely they are to report depression, anxiety, as well as loneliness. One final part about that, which I think is also worth mentioning, it's been a decade or so since the great financial crisis. And what has been observed in the last 5 to 7 years is something Dr. Vivek Murthy, the former Surgeon General under President Obama, identified, and that's a loneliness epidemic. This was occurring long before this viral epidemic. And loneliness epidemic has been observed throughout the age span, young people, middle-aged people, older people. It's especially rated quite high in younger people. And so we have the entire population reporting levels of loneliness that are increased relative to 2 decades ago. People would use the words loneliness epidemic. And against this background of loneliness, COVID-19 waltzes into our lives.
Well, that leads me into my next question. You're saying loneliness was a problem before we were even all put in quarantine and kind of in this position. So tell me about what was going on before. Why is it so rampant in young people? And then how is that being kind of ramped up now as we social distance as a globe, I guess?
You know, the loneliness epidemic that's been now identified in the United States and Canada has also been identified in countries around the world. So any effort to try and come up with an explanation for the loneliness epidemic, by definition, will need to be encompassing. In other words, it'll need to have a broader reach, because it's not an observation confined to a single county or a state or to a country. It's a global phenomenon. In fact, the United Kingdom government, the UK government, has a minister of loneliness as part of their House of Parliament.
Oh, wow.
Speaking to the seriousness that the government sees this issue. Why do they see it so serious? Well, because it's been shown through other lines of research that people who report high levels of loneliness are also more likely to experience chronic medical diseases like obesity and heart disease and diabetes and premature death. And to quantify that in relative terms, the increase in mortality associated with obesity has been often equated to smoking 15 cigarettes per day. So we all know that doesn't sound good. And so this is not, as you know, in medicine, many things are statistically significant, but they're not really that clinically relevant. But I think we can agree this sounds clinically relevant. So this has been observed in Asian countries. It's been observed in European countries. It's been a global phenomenon. The second part about that is that why some demographic groups, that is younger people and older people, are more affected is still, in fact, not fully understood. A explanation that's often put forward for the older population, sorry, is perhaps maybe obvious, that because they're older and because of loss of interpersonal radius and through death, age-related death and so on, people's social interpersonal worlds become smaller as they get older. And that's not difficult to grasp. But that also, in fact, does introduce the importance of a glossary, which sometimes people confuse. And that is, social isolation is not the same thing as loneliness. And many people are socially isolated who are not the least bit lonely. And there are many people who are sitting in a room right now with 5 other people in the room who would describe themselves as exceedingly lonely. So those are they're correlated, but they're not the same thing. Socially isolated refers to what it sounds like. To what degree are you in proximity to other people? But loneliness is defined as the degree to which you have meaningful, substantial interpersonal relations. They overlap, but they're not the same thing. And the hazards of loneliness are related to loneliness, less about social isolation. It's more loneliness. Now, again, I keep emphasizing they're correlated. What I'm getting at is that there's many older people who've lost friends and family because of age and so on, who would not rate themselves as lonely, even though they're incredibly socially isolated. But again, they correlate. The issue with younger people is tricky. It's challenging. We don't know, is a short answer. There has been a lot of emphasis placed on some of the macro changes that are occurring. In other words, we are seeing, you know, changes in the family structure, less of the, in quotes, traditional family structure. We're seeing, in fact, less involvement in religious groups and religious affiliation, less involvement in community organizations and volunteer groups. And we're seeing increased urbanization, where the caricature of the urbanite is someone who lives in a condo by themselves. And so there's a host of factors that are at play that are all coherent and all possibly contributory, but it's difficult to come up with a simple one-size-fits-all explanation. Perhaps the elephant in the room when it comes especially to younger people is social media. And it's often said that the world has never been so connected, and yet the world's never been so lonely. And people have attempted to determine whether there's something about social media that is inherently promoting loneliness. It's a complex story that doesn't lend itself to what I refer to as kind of a bumper sticker kind of slogan or kind of line around this. It's complicated because cause and effect here is difficult to suss out. You could argue that people spend more time on social media because they are not just isolated, but also lonely. Others would say, well, that's, yeah, possible, but others feel, in fact, that the availability of social media promotes social isolation, and the anonymity of social media also really works against meaningful attachments with other people, so it inherently promotes loneliness. I don't think that these are mutually exclusive possibilities. I think that we have to accept that there may be something about social media that may be promoting some of this, with the proviso that, you know, there's results that are going in different directions on this. What was interesting is, you know, I mentioned earlier in China, where I've just finished a study looking at the impact of COVID-19 on the stress in the general population, and especially amongst healthcare providers, we found that depression and anxiety increased, as did measures of stress, and that doesn't surprise anybody. What we also found is the more time you spent on social media, the more stressed people were. So I guess there's two non-mutually exclusive possibilities. Perhaps people who are more stressed and depressed to begin with, because they're so stressed, are reaching out to social media more than others, driven by that anxiety. The other way of thinking about it is that there's something about being exposed to the contagion of fear and everything else that is amplifying people's anxiety and depression. So again, these are not mutually exclusive. So I think that we don't know what's driving the loneliness epidemic across the age band, but I think there is a view that there are social and economic factors, urbanicity, and possibly technology that are all on the list as potential suspects.
You can catch part two of this with Dr. McIntyre talking about some healthy ways to cope with loneliness and isolation in tomorrow's episode. And until then, this has been another episode of Radio MD COVID-19 Daily. If you want to reach out to us with news or something good you saw in your community, we're at COVID19Daily@radiomd.com. That's COVID19Daily@radiomd.com. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews, and we hope that you join us. I'm Caitlin White. Stay home and stay healthy.